The first time I was here many years ago, Alan Griffin whisked me from the airport to see a movie. So that was one adventure. And yesterday I barely made it here. We had, you know, like big hailstorms. The temperature was really high and we had these big pellet-sized hailstorms and all the flights were getting cancelled except somehow my flight took off. So that was the second adventure. And I hope today I can take you into this another adventure at low temperatures, and maybe there are new, yet more phases to discover near Toronto. Here is, I'll tell you about some phases that, you know, have revealed themselves over many, many years. So I'm going to give a very broad talk and then, you know, slowly funnel into more recent things and things that I'm working on, but I'll try to keep a very broad perspective. Just so I know everyone here is from very different aspects of physics, so hopefully, you know, we can all kind of enter this adventure together. So in a way, you know, physics we can think of as coming from questions related to very small things and dimensions, and that's basically the realm of string theory and high energy physics. Then the physics of the very large, that's basically astrophysics and cosmology. And condensed matter physics essentially fits in investigating questions about physics of the very complex. Now, what is interesting or what is profound is that this complex behavior arises from the interaction of many particles. But the important thing is that, you know, that in itself would just be a big zoo. But what is really important is that a lot of this complexity can be understood as arising from simple local interactions. And that's what makes you feel that, yes, maybe one can get a deeper understanding of that. So I really like this these pictures from Picasso. And he has a sequence of actually 19 bulls, each one with ever greater simplification, ultimately ending with that. And you can see that's the reality, that's Mother Nature, and this is the theorist. And and you can see that theorists are becoming sophisticated. It's not a spherical cow. It has structure. And so, you know, there's a hope that we can say something. So this also brings up another very profound aspect of theory. The aim of theory is not kind of to do curve fitting and explain every detail of experiment, but, you know, it's really to understand nature. So to that extent, this encapsulates sort of the philosophy of what I would like to do. We will look at complex systems, but try to elicit from that a model and then hopefully get a very deep understanding of where that kind of physics came from. So this, these two pictures really kind of crystallize that. And the kind of physics I'm talking about are starting with these elementary particles. When you put many of them together, the questions are related to emergent properties. So you have particles which do not necessarily have a particular property, but you put them together and these new properties emerge. That's the kind of effort that is broadly what is in the scope of condensed matter physics. And today's talk, I will basically emphasize these kinds of new collective behavior as arising from two main ingredients, basically putting quantum mechanics and many particles together. And that, from that soup, will come out these different properties. So what are some of these properties that I have in mind? You know, you're very familiar with them. They are around us all the time. We know about phase transitions from gas to liquid to solid as the temperature is reduced, and one property that emerges is rigidity. So, you know, an atom doesn't have rigidity, but when you put it together in the solid phase, that stuff does have rigidity. Similarly, there are other things like magnetism, superconductivity, and so on, which are also emergent properties. And of course, the most profound of all this is life. And hopefully, you know, we will have something to say on how it emerges. There is lots of work going on these biochips, which gives some direction to these kinds of questions. Okay. Now, before I really get into this, whole story of the different phases, I wanted to bring out one other aspect of condensed matter physics, and that is that not only does it have, address some deep fundamental questions, it also has lots of connections with applications. And this is a set of pictures that I found rather, profound. You all know these people, Bardeen, Shockley, and Bratin, discovering the first transistor. So it begins, with like little ideas, little waves in the brain. And then here comes the first transistor in 1947. It was large, about many inches in size. And today, on the tip of a finger, on just the tip, you can fit about 5 million transistors in your Pentium. So it's amazing that in some 50 years, one has gone through such a huge development and applications. Okay, so now let's talk about low temperatures. So let's start with the sun. It's essentially at 10 million degrees at the core, all the way down to about 6,000 degrees centigrade at the surface. And that temperature is essentially the temperature of the Earth at the core. And at the surface, Toronto, of course, is not at that temperature, nor is Ohio. It fluctuates all the time. But some temperature around few centigrade. Okay, yet colder, and nature reveals itself in these beautiful crystal shapes. Then we have these pondering marchers. I'm sure you've all seen this movie. It's really fantastic that something like this has hit the blockbuster scene. So here are these adults marching away. These little penguin kids are probably deliberating on more profound questions like, why do new phases occur at low temperatures? And, one of them has the idea that it's basically the free energy that determines why you have these different phases. So we'll talk more about free energies and energies, but essentially I wanted to just draw your attention to the fact that, you go through this sequence of gases to liquids to solids. One important fact is that helium at ambient pressure does not solidify. It remains a liquid, and around 3 degrees Kelvin, you hit the temperature of interstellar space. So whatever you see beyond that in the lab is something that nature hasn't explored, okay? Because this is where our universe has come to after the Big Bang. It has cooled to about 3 degrees Kelvin, and the conditions we can create in the lab are able to explore phases that the universe hasn't seen. Okay, so let me just touch briefly on phase transitions that are driven by temperature. This is beautiful work done in the 70s, and a very nice theories. Leading person was Ken Wilson. And this is stuff I know you're all familiar with, but I just want to set the stage and contrast it with the quantum analog, which is to come. So essentially, as the penguins were saying, it's the free energy we want to minimize, which is U minus TS. At low temperatures, the energy dominates, and at high temperatures, the entropy that dominates. And that basically, in a magnetic system, let's say, drives the transition from a ferromagnet, which is ordered, to a paramagnet at high temperatures. So in such a phase transition, you can describe it by an order parameter, which is basically the spin at any site, the average spin in that phase. At high temperatures, it's greatly fluctuating, so the average spin is zero. Here it is ordered, and you get a finite value. So there is a broken symmetry. The symmetry of the spin being in any direction is broken, and you get ordering. Now, in this problem, we can basically understand the whole behavior just in terms of the interaction of spins and competition with temperature. Now, let's say we bring the temperature all the way to zero. So in that scale that I just showed you, let's say we crank down all the way to zero temperature. So now we have no thermal energy to start disturbing these spins or what have you. or in, let's say, a solid system. Let's say I had atoms. They were gaseous at high temperatures, then they became a liquid, and then they formed a solid. And now you would say, okay, it's formed a solid, matter, the whole story is over. But let's say you're at zero temperature with these atoms sitting in perfect positions. The question is, what is really happening? That picture of a solid formed or with atoms sitting in perfect positions is a classical picture. You know, quantum mechanically, the position cannot be completely well defined. So that is where quantum mechanics rears its head and new things start to happen. So the fact that helium doesn't solidify and remains a super solid has to do with that. More recently, this has gotten a huge burst of activity with Bose-Einstein condensation in alkali atoms. Also, electrons in metals are completely quantum mechanical, and at the analog of superfluidity in fermion systems is superconductivity found by these people. So these are all famous names. That's Kapitza, Cornell, Ketterly, and Wyman, who I believe is coming to Canada now. And this is Landau, Kamerling, Ohms, who first discovered superconductivity in mercury, and this is these three are Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer, the people who proposed the theory for superconductivity. And this is a very special year, 2007, because it's 50 years since that classic paper of theirs which produced the theory of superconductivity as it existed then. And what is amazing is in 50 years, there's been, you know, one would have thought, you know, there were these experiments, then came their theory, and they made beautiful predictions. The matter was closed. It was a done deal. But in these 50 years, there's been a huge amount of activity in superconductivity, and I won't take you through that. But basically, you know, this is another element of condensed matter physics. There's a lot of dialogue with material scientists and chemists and so on, and they are great at producing all kinds of materials, and they have all kinds of different properties, and these have actually, some of them have essentially extended the scope of superconductivity as BCS had proposed, but some others have actually challenged those old paradigms. So this has been a very rich field. And now coming back to that temperature scale, you can see we need to go into a log scale because you saw there was hardly any distance between 2.73 and 0. So I've made a log scale here. That's room temperature. I will tell you a little bit about some of these phases. High temperature superconductors, helium-4, helium-3. These are becoming superfluid as you go down. And the cold atoms are way down here. Actually, the lowest temperature is picokelvin. And it's mind-boggling how you can get to such a temperature. But essentially, it needed completely different kinds of experimental techniques to, you know, so this is also kind of interesting. You have a certain cooling technique. And, you know, for a while, one is making different kinds of modifications. And you can get a few decades down. But then, suddenly, a completely new technology comes in. And you can, you know, cross orders of magnitude. And today the record is about 500 picokelvin by Ketterly's group. Okay, so what is at the core of low temperature physics? Basically, what you get is that quantum effects are going to start manifesting themselves in the following way. Let's say I have a bunch of atoms or electrons or what have you, and they are in a box at some density. So there's some mean distance between them. Because of quantum mechanics, there's an uncertainty in the position, which is basically given by h over square root of kT times the mass. And so that tells you that as you, and that generates a certain amount of fuzziness in the location of these atoms. And that fuzziness grows as you make the temperature lower or the mass lighter. So let's say the fuzziness has they've gotten more fuzzed up as I go to lower temperatures. And now the wave functions of these different particles start to overlap. And once it does that, the whole system becomes now a quantum soup, or which can have different names. If these are bosons, then all of these particles, once they are overlapping, will like to get into the same quantum state. And that's what it looks like. So all the bosons will just make a nice, they kind of get very coordinated. They each lose their identity. It's like the ultimate, you know, nirvana. You lose yourself and, you know, become whatever it is people talk about. I'm not particularly, but it's something like that. So they become like one giant atom. It happens at very low temperatures, but these, now this is a PowerPoint picture, but here is a real measurement of the Bose-Einstein condensate. This is actually taken from the Gila group by Cornell, and this is an imaging of the density of these cold atoms. It basically shows that at zero momentum, which is sitting here, you have a huge number of particles, and it dies down as you go to higher momenta. So that's the condensation of all the particles into one single zero momentum state. So that's the wonderland. I think it's beautiful. I don't know what your picture of wonderland was, but you know, I think this is a beautiful wonderland, that everything has become very cooperative and they are all together. Okay, here is this is from Wyman's group, and he's really big on all these applets, and they're kind of nice because they show, as you lower the temperature, the growth of the number of particles at that zero state. I'll show it once more. So here's the temperature dropping, and this is a picture showing the distribution of particles at different momenta. Okay. So that was some years ago, and you know, these people were awarded the Nobel Prize. But another aspect of condensed matter is, once you have one thing under control, now you want to start tinkering or start playing with it. Can you do more things to that condensate? So these people listed here basically decided that, okay, let us try to make a lattice. So here are these particles sitting in some kind of a box, some parabolic box, and they could shine lasers from different directions. From the interference pattern, they could make a laser field which had a certain modulation, and that way make an optical lattice. So you can see that, you know, we have lattices in solids, but here is a way of engineering a lattice. And using that, they could now take that superfluid or that Bose condensed state and impose this periodic potential. And now it gives us a knob to play with. So we have seen how we have gone from going to very low temperatures, producing a quantum state, the Bose condensed state, and now generating another knob on it, which will be the strength of the laser field. And what that strength will do is, you can put either a small undulation of the laser field, or you can really deepen it and make huge undulations. And what that does is that, very simply, it maps this problem onto what is called the Bose-Hubbard model. So here is now the real system, that complicated bull, to my model. And it is amazingly simple model you can write down. What it has is just two terms, basically. You have these different lattice points, and there's one term, you don't need to worry about all the details, but there's one term, hopping, T, which controls how these bosons move from one site to another. What is the energy of that? And there's another term here, U, which basically comes from the fact that if you put two bosons at the same site, there's a certain repulsion. So basically, by changing the strength of the laser field, you can tune these two energies, T and U, and really it's the ratio of U over T which is important. So let's see how that will drive different... let's see what it'll do to the different to the phases. So you can see from here, here's that Hamiltonian again, there's a hopping and the U. When U is small, U over T is small. Okay, so that basically says that my tunneling, it's easy to think in terms of basic of the tunneling being very very strong. Then the system would like to be, these are bosons, so the quantum effects are allowing them to tunnel from one side to another, and they would essentially go into a superfluid phase. So that's here. As you crank up this ratio of U over T at large interactions, okay, let's say we were sitting at a particular filling where I had these different wells and I had essentially one boson per well. Then since now U is large, that's going to prevent the bosons from hopping from one side to another. And so it drives the system into a new kind of insulator, which is called a Mott insulator. Okay, so we knew about superfluids before from helium. We knew about superfluids in the Bose-Einstein condensation, but this insulator is a new phase. It didn't exist before in just the simple trap. It's been generated by putting this periodic lattice. And so this slide contains the essence of quantum phase transitions. And what is that essence? You can see, unlike temperature, which is usually the driving field for going from one phase to another, gas to liquid to solid or what have you, here it's not temperature. It is another parameter which is in the Hamiltonian. Okay, so it's not an external parameter. It's a parameter in the Hamiltonian which takes you from one phase to another phase. And basically, these phases are described by like an uncertainty relation. Delta X, delta A, delta P is H. So one phase, like this one, the superfluid phase, is dominated by large amount of number fluctuations. You see, because this phase has a small periodic potential, there are many number fluctuations. But the phase of the order parameter, now I'm using the word phase a little differently, but the angle or the phase of the order parameter is fixed. On the other hand, the insulating phase here has one boson at every site. So it has a fixed number, but it is dominated by the conjugate variable, the phase fluctuations. And it's this competition that then drives this transition. Okay, now a small word about how one could even try to address these problems theoretically. And one way is, we all know about doing these calculations in a classical problem. So here z is trace e to the minus beta h. That's the partition function. Once we have the partition function, we could go to town and calculate whatever we wanted. This problem can be basically cast in terms of Feynman paths of these different bosons. This is space, this is time, and the name of the game is to try to figure out what the sum over all these different paths is. And depending on the kind of phase you are in, different configurations of these paths will contribute. And that is how, in a calculation, you can probe these. Now, these were some simulations done many, many years ago when we calculated the superfluid density as a function of this parameter U over T and indeed found that transition. And at that time, when we first did this, people were always asking, what's the point of this? Is this a model calculation? But it's kind of nice. Many years later, it has seen a realization of that. So now, more recently, we can do even more refined calculations. So if this is the chemical potential, this is T over U, or I was showing you U over T until now, but I switched a little bit here. So this is the Mott phase, this is the superfluid phase, and we can do even more detailed calculations now with much better computers and very important Japanese collaborators who have a lot of muscle. And we can now, basically see that transition very clearly. So here is T over U. This is the Mott insulator at small hopping, and this is the growth of the superfluid. Now, I don't want you to take you into details because I want to keep stepping back and giving you a broad picture, but there are many aspects of this quantum phase transition one can go into. What are the universality classes and what are the exponents? These are questions just like the old case. But to me, what is really interesting is to ask, what are the phases? Is there something new that quantum mechanics has given us? Okay, so I'll not go too much into detail, but there is lots of interesting things you can do here. Now, these are some beautiful experiments. That's another nice thing. There's a lot of dialogue between theory and experiment in the cold atom case. Here are some experiments with the optical lattice, and you can see that when the system is in a superfluid, you remember I said that in the superfluid there are lots of number fluctuations, and as a result the angle or the phase of the order parameter is well defined. That means you can do an interference experiment and see these bosons interfering. And this is the interference pattern you get when the system is in the superfluid phase. So if you have not tuned the laser field a lot, you get that. But as you go into the MOT phase, the interference pattern is lost. So it's a direct imaging of that MOT superfluid transition. Okay, so the essential aspects that emerge are that we are looking at the quantum statistical mechanics of many degrees of freedom at zero temperature. Okay, and essentially what we are seeing are the same particles interacting by the same interactions, let's say in this case U, but the ground state. So it's a story not about a thermal population, but this, a story about the ground state and how it likes to organize itself. You know, so let's say, you know, we were a bunch of bosons, and just by tuning this U over T, we organize ourselves in different ways depending on what the interactions are telling us to do. And that's essentially the crux of what is involved in a quantum phase transition. It involves the nature of the phases and how you go between them. And there are many ways to tune this. I was talking to several of you today, and many people here are looking at these kinds of transitions by tuning them with different ways, either with density or pressure or magnetic field and even disorder. And that generates phases with distinct properties. So I won't go take you through all this, but basically one of the attractions of cold atoms for people in condensed matter physics is that it is emerging as a laboratory for, dialing in the kind of Hamiltonian you want. So, you know, we'll be able to sort of tell our colleague in cold atoms and say, you know, we want a Hubbard model with such and such a lattice. You know, they can make different lattice types and different kinds of objects. They could be fermions or bosons, and they can tune the interaction. It's amazing the degree of tunability that has been achieved. Typically, in condensed matter physics, you are dealing with a solid state system. And if you say, well, could you change, you know, the interaction by this? And they say, okay, we have to go to the periodic table, make another chemistry mixture and get another parameter. And who knows, along with that, there is all this disorder and other things which you didn't want. But this is emerging. I mean, maybe it's a dream, but maybe this will basically engender a big connection between condensed matter and atomic physics. So while that is still not happened, we still don't have some of these Hubbard models all ready to order, let us look at electrons in another system. So I'm going to shift now from bosons to electrons. And I will do that in the context of high-temperature superconductors. Now, maybe you've heard a lot about it, so I will just say a few things about this system, just bringing out more points on phase transitions. So this is the system. It is a complicated system with many elements, and that's one of the things physicists are scared of. You know, too many elements, it's like too much chemistry. You don't want to deal with it. But, you know, the amazing thing is this complicated system, again, in that bull picture, at the underlying level, is really simple. It's just a square lattice of electrons. So you just have to think of a square lattice of electrons residing on these copper atoms. And this whole story broke in 1986 with Bednarz and Mueller, who suddenly discovered that, the transition temperature where the system went superconducting suddenly shot up from around 30 degrees to around 80, 90, but today it's at about 170 degrees. And this is kind of interesting. Matthias, who's a famous experimental physicist, he had certain rules. He had made many explorations in superconductivity, granddaddy of superconductivity. He had certain rules that you had to avoid insulators, avoid magnetism, avoid oxygen. And all of these are broken here. he may still be right about the last one. So, essentially, the high temperature superconductivity story is a really beautiful one. It basically says that this paradigm of BCS, which reigned supreme for so many years, had to be questioned, and you need to replace it with a new paradigm. And the problem is still not solved, but many pieces of the puzzle have really fallen into place. Okay, so let me skip that. So once again, okay, I showed you that complicated material. How can we understand it? There's a Hubbard model underlying this that I believe captures most of the essential physics. And it's a Hubbard model now for electrons. Very similar terms. There's one term there. So again, think of this. It's a square lattice. Thankfully, nature gave us a simple enough lattice that we can draw. Even a triangular lattice, you know, gets complicated. So it's nice. It's a square lattice. And let's say I start with one electron at every site. So now, just like the boson case, I have a hopping term. The electrons block from one site to another. And there's a U term which says, just like the U term in the boson case, no two bosons at the same site, this says no two fermions of opposite spin at the same site. Of course, if they have the same spin, they are anyway not allowed by Pauli exclusion. So this model was introduced by Hubbard, and essentially you can see that this model tells us that at half filling, which is this filling, this is just one electron per site filling. Okay, typically if you had no U, suppose U was absent or U was very small, then essentially these electrons could have hopped and the system would be metallic because it can conduct. There is motion of these electrons. But now at large U, you can see this electron will not be able to hop to the other site. So once again we see the emergence of an insulating phase, which is called again a Mott phase, a Mott insulator. So let me show you the evidence for that. Here is the resistivity as a function of temperature. And let's look at just the top curve. This curve is at one electron per site filling. And you can see as you go to lower temperatures, it starts shooting up. The resistance goes up. So that's an indication. High resistance means it's an insulator. So that's an indication that the system has become an insulator, but driven by strong interaction effects. Now, okay, so you know now that each site must have one electron. But what can you say about how the spins are oriented? And there's a very simple argument. You can just show that if the two spins were in the same direction, the system can't lower its energy at all because the other electron can't hop. But if they had opposite spins, the electron can hop and the system can lower its energy by second order perturbation theory. So it naturally generates antiferromagnetism, okay, from this model. And that's indeed the kind of order that has been seen in the experiments. So this is, by the way, so one of the things you can do in this system is this particular filling where you have one electron per site is an insulator and it is also magnetic. Okay, so there goes Matthias's two rules. Now, that by itself doesn't show the superconductivity property. You have to remove some of these electrons, make a few holes, like, you know, in this room, there are a few holes here. So if we had to move, we could actually move here. So once you do that, the system becomes superconducting, and here is a beautiful data from Paul Chu's group, actually, showing resistivity versus temperature and the sharp drop at about 100 Kelvin. Okay. So there's a phase diagram you can draw for this. Here's temperature. Here is X, which is the number of holes. So starting out right here is the Mott insulator, which is antiferromagnetic. You make some holes and you get a superconductor. Okay, now I want to draw I won't tell you the whole story. It's a big story and it's really too much for this. I want to just focus on one key feature of the superconductors. You notice here that there are two temperature scales. So you notice that TC is one temperature scale which tells you how the superconducting temperature changes with doping. Okay, and it has this particular shape. And there's another temperature scale here which is related to the gap in a superconductor. Okay, I haven't told you this, but a superconductor essentially involves pairing, which you know, and the strength of that pairing shows up as a gap. Now, in all BCS superconductors, one of the identifying features is that the temperature at which the gap opens up and the temperature at which it shows, you know, this TC, at which the system shows sort of overall long-range coherence is identical. So there's only one energy scale in a typical BCS superconductor, whereas here you see there are two energy scales. Now, what is the origin of this? Turns out that this U term, the strong correlation term, is at the heart of that physics and how it generates two energy scales. So basically, again, coming to the phases, what you are starting to see is, forget about finite temperatures, look at zero temperatures. You see many quantum phase transitions, all driven by, let's say, either doping or chemical potential or some tuning parameter like that, going from a Fermi liquid, which is a canonical electron metal, to a superconductor, to, you know, maybe something else going on here, to insulating physics. Okay, so I told you about one theoretical way to address it, which was using path integrals. There's another powerful way of addressing problems when you have no clue as to how to do a theory for this. And that is precisely in situations, you know, I said that in these problems, the ground state readjusts and gets into a new kind of organization. Now, that's a very complicated thing to happen because we all know how to do perturbation theory. You know something and then you perturb around that and look at little fluctuations. But if suddenly the ground state changes and does something completely different, now you don't know how to proceed because any perturbation theory will never take you across that critical point. So a very powerful method are variational methods where you guess a wave function, not quite guess, and that's what I'll take you through, but you kind of you think of a wave function and then you try to check how good is this. And this has proven to be extremely useful for helium-4, quantum Hall effect, BCS superconductivity, and in this case, also for high TC cube rates. So this is very general, so I thought I would share it with you because it may even be useful in some of the things you are doing. Essentially, what you do is you start with, let's say if I had to look at these bosons I described, strongly interacting bosons. You turn off the interactions and you know that in that case, all the bosons like to sit in the zero momentum state. So that's this wave function here. Now you can build in correlations by saying, well, this wave function says nothing about how two particles behave when they are close to each other. I'm going to put that in through some additional correlation physics. And you can put such correlation factors to improve that wave function. Similar ideas hold also for the quantum Hall effect, which I won't talk about. And so now what we decided to do, this was work in which was basically Arun's thesis, we decided to address the problem of high temperature superconductivity using variational methods, because here was a problem where we didn't have much idea how to handle the strong correlations, and the idea was, let's try to put in some of the physics in the wave function. And this is the way you can do it. Here is the term which says, well, take the pairs. Now, superconductors have pairs. So here is a K up and a minus K down pair, and it's in some pairing state, phi K, and you put N over 2 pairs in the same state. Now, that would be a BCS superconductor. That's our old garden variety BCS superconductor. They may not like the garden variety part, so let's just say BCS superconductor. And now you say, okay, we have to put in some additional physics. So that is being put in through this projection right here, which puts the strong correlation effect. And what we find is that the properties of this wave function and this wave function are completely different. In fact, this psi zero wave function essentially goes on to explain a lot of the phenomenology of the high TC superconducting state. It was first proposed by Anderson, and then it went through some modifications and how we actually implemented it. But this is a picture of the wave function. Okay, it has different kinds of singlets, and these singlets cover the whole lattice. Okay, let me not go through that. I want to just show you one picture which brings out those two energy scales coming out of this wave function. So if I take just that wave function and look at what is the gap, you find that this wave function contains a gap in the excitation spectrum, and that gap grows as you go toward the insulator. On the other hand, if you look at something like an order parameter or superfluid density, it has this dome-like shape. So essentially, the origin of the two energy scales comes out again from just this one simple ingredient of strong interactions. Okay. Now, in the last few minutes, I want to touch on another tuning knob. So we talked about interactions. We talked about various things. Another thing, you know, that I've been involved in is disorder. Now, you might say, you know, why do you want to muck up the whole scenario? You know, we have nice, pristine samples. Why even study disorder? And basically, the reason for that is, okay, that it exists. You know, we should not study it, but it exists, and it actually leads to new kinds of phenomena. Okay, for example, the quantum Hall effect. You may not know this, but you know, it has. Of course, you know this part, that it has these beautiful plateaus. You know, quantized to one part in 10 to the billion, or in 10 to not 10 to the billion, to 10 to the 8 or something. But you can get these plateaus only if the system has some crud in it. If you made an absolutely perfect, theoretically perfect sample, or even experimentally perfect sample, you would just get a straight line like this, no plateaus. Okay, so it does lead to these new kinds of effects. Also, in a superconductor, when we say it has zero resistance in a magnetic field, it has vortices, and if these vortices move, the system doesn't have zero resistance. It's only if you have some crud, you know, these superconductors which are being used to make those levitating trains one of these days. They have to have some crud. If they were perfect, you wouldn't have the superconducting properties. So that's one reason to look at disorder. It does generate new phases. And moreover, from a theoretical point of view, there has been this beautiful work in the 80s by Anderson and collaborators, essentially making some very strong statements that, let's say you had a random potential and a single particle in a random potential. You know, something like this. So you can imagine that if the random potential is weak, the wave function of the electron or particle would be extended. It would be like a metal. If you make a lot of these fluctuations, you'll basically localize the particle. Now, this seems pretty obvious, right? But they made an important statement that in two dimensions, they were able to show using a scaling theory that you cannot have any metallic behavior in 2D. All the wave functions, no matter how small the disorder, will be localized. This was challenged by some experiments. Actually, I should have shown you that experiment first. So this was challenged by these experiments where they took perfectly two-dimensional samples in these gallium arsenide quantum wells, and they were able to change the density in these samples, or equivalently increase the disorder going this way, and they could see that when the disorder was high, this is now in two dimensions. The system is insulating, which is what you expect. But when they went to low enough disorder, the system turned around and showed metallic behavior. So now the question was, what is going on here? So what we decided to investigate was to ask this question. Okay. We know that interactions by themselves like to localize, like we saw in the Mott insulator. Disorder by itself also likes to localize. What would happen if you have both interactions and disorder? Could they cooperate and generate some of these metal-like phases? And the answer is yes. You know, even though both individually localize, the two together are able to make metals. So let me show you that as a very quick evidence in one example. So it's back to that Mott insulator. We have these two terms, and we have two energy scales. We have an insulator, which means there is a gap in the spectrum. The size of this gap is U, which in real materials is about 2 electron volts. And there's the other scale, J, which is antiferromagnetic ordering. The scale for that is about 100 millivolts. Now, this is a simple question. I say, okay, here are these two energy scales. Let me add disorder to this system. Which energy scale will get killed first? Okay, the natural intuition would be the lower the energy scale, that is the one which will first get killed and then the next one. But what we find is, this is what we find, that it's the energy gap which gets, so this, what I'm showing here is the gap as a function of disorder. V is the strength of those fluctuations. And the gap gets killed at some disorder, but the antiferromagnetic correlations remain up to a much higher disorder. So what you have, on one side you have the Mott insulator, on the other side you have sort of a localized insulator, and in the middle you end up getting, even though you're increasing the disorder, you end up getting a metal. And that is coming about because of this very interesting cooperation. So, let me skip that. And let me just end by saying that today, another interesting direction in which a lot of work is going into in terms of experiments are local probes, which are able to do spectroscopy at different sites. So we also make a lot of connection with scanning tunneling spectroscopy, which can, you know, instead of just telling you what is the system like at one point or another point, I mean, overall, it can actually give you positional information. So especially for disordered systems, this is a big tool because you can find out the density of states at different places. And, you know, one can try to correlate that with lots of information. And not only can you do scanning tunneling with just looking at how the charge is moving, but you can also make a tip which is magnetic and try to probe what the magnetism is at different points. So, for example, in the problem that I just talked about of the Mott insulator, what you find is that the system looks like an antiferromagnet at low disorder, which is what you are beginning with. As you make it disordered, it gets patchy, and the origin of the metal is sitting in this patchiness, and you have to be able to probe that. So these local probes are making it possible to do that. It's also possible to probe superconductivity on local scales by these kinds of probes. Okay. So let me just end then by saying that I hope what I've shown you are some examples of how quantum mechanics and many particles come together in generating different kinds of phases. Now, I've listed many more here, like quantum magnets. For example, that antiferromagnet I talked about is itself a very interesting object. It's not a garden variety up, down kind of state. That would have been a classical antiferromagnet. So there are lots of interesting questions about quantum fluctuations in that state by itself. Then spin liquids, which are another huge class of systems. You know, if you look at other kinds of lattices, which are not square but triangular or other frustrated lattices, you can get these spin liquids. Superfluids, superconductors, lots of other ways in which electrons like to organize themselves. This is a whole lot of activity in these fields. But what is always driving this, at the core of it, is the competition between two terms or more terms in the Hamiltonian. It's always quantum. One, a quantum aspect which is trying to delocalize things, another aspect which is trying to localize things. And that is driving these phases. And I hope I've given you some flavor for how from this complicated zoo of things you can extract simple Hubbard-type models which at least have the potential of containing some of that physics. A little bit about different theoretical techniques which might address these problems and, you know, some work, some connections with local probes. Okay, thank you. Okay, so pseudo gap phase. So let me just see. So So what I described was a wave function that works here, and your question is about the pseudo-gap phase. So the pseudo-gap phase, we believe, is coming from the fact that So it's a very interesting phase. So since we have two energy scales, you can imagine, this was the story at zero temperature. You can imagine if I'm at finite temperatures, when I'm at temperatures much above the gap, then of course you have free fermions. When you hit a temperature which is on the scale of delta, you start to get pairs of electrons. But these pairs, you can think of them as diatomic molecules. Their orientation is completely random. They are all over the map. And that's the structure of the pseudo-gap phase. At further lowering of temperature, when you hit an energy scale of order phi, then these different molecules line up and become coherent, and then you enter the superconducting phase. But that having been said, there are still many mysteries right now about the angle-resolved photoemission has brought out some beautiful some mysteries about the pseudo-gap phase in terms of Fermi arcs. And that stuff is still not completely understood. So there are still many questions. So right now, the HITC story is in terms of this phase diagram. This part is, I think, completely under control. This part is under control. These phases, you see the normal state phases here and here, are still not very well understood. We just looked at, I didn't say that, but basically we had just some random potential at every site which was coupled to the density. You could have other kinds of disorder where it might couple to the hopping and so on, and they do have different effects at half filling.
But in this particular
case, it's under basically. Right. You can put in another kind of disorder. Usually what happens in these systems is you dope one element by another element. So that kind of disorder is more like a binary disorder. And that is also gives completely the same qualitative results. Yeah.
Let me ask a question about your variational calculation. If you're saying in part variational calculation is not perturbative, but like you're mentioning, when you introduce, in some sense, repairs into a variational BCS-type wave function and then try to adjust the parameters in it, that's, of course, begging the question, right? We're already imposing some idea of what's going on. And how do you know if your initial idea is wrong?
Right.
The variational calculation still might give you numbers, but even though it's based on incorrect physics.
Right. So that's why it requires a lot of intuition. And the only way you can know that, I mean, you have some internal checks. You could test, if you had ideas for, let's say, three possible phases, it could be A, B, or C, you could test, you could write wave functions for each of them and then look at the energetics. But there could be a phase D, which you didn't even dream of, which could be lower in energy, and that you wouldn't discover. You might see some instabilities toward that. I mean, you might see that this phase is becoming unstable, but you wouldn't know what it is becoming unstable to. So, you know, this is, of course, not the, basically for many particle systems which are strongly interacting, we don't have any exact theorems. If you state it generally enough, if you say, okay, two particles interacting in this dimension with lots of constraints, sure, you can prove some exact results. But by and large, there are no exact results. So variational methods is just one way to go. Yeah.
You know, where you don't start off with any idea.
Right.
But presumably, are you implying that that approach doesn't necessarily help?
So I guess what I'm implying.
Putting enough physics in it.
Right. No, certainly, you know, what Alan is asking is a very important question. You know, if you are doing numerical work, why don't you just take the Hamiltonian and just run with it? the point is, I mean, this brings what it is bringing out is, you know, you need many tools in your box because no one tool will do it because you don't have an exact result. So the reason you saw that for bosons, I wrote a path integral and then that method for bosons was essentially exact. What I mean is that if you did the path integral sampling is done using Monte Carlo methods. And if you do enough number of Monte Carlo steps, you can essentially get exact results. For the fermions, that same method is not going to work because of lots of there's an essential problem of fermions. They have wave functions that have nodes. And these nodes are positive somewhere, tell you that it divides up the region into positive and negative parts. There are big cancellations between them, leaving you with basically zero. So that's why you have to step back and try another more approximate method. So it's always good to have many techniques. Then you can decide, okay, this can work with that or that can work with that. And ultimately, it's also useful to touch base with some more analytical methods to really understand what's going on. Yeah. That's a good question. You could look at ratios, you know, like, so it's true that you have interactions and essentially, let's say, the density would tune the Fermi energy. Okay, so if I looked at dimensionless quantities, then you could generate those dimensionless quantities to have the same regimes as in condensed matter systems. So, for example, if you look at TC over EF, you know, the transition temperature over the Fermi energy in high-temperature superconductors, TC is 100, about 200, say 100 Kelvin. EF is about, you know, 1 electron volts. That's 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So that ratio is quite small. Actually, the cold atoms are able to take TC over EF to something like 0.3. So they are actually even more strongly coupled than the cold atoms. So if you look at ratios, one could still make lots of comparisons. Thank you.